Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply. Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
Sports Radio 610 presents Payne and Pendergast, presented by Allied Home Security.
Good morning, everybody. Sean Pendergast is off watching the graduations of both his sons, Sammy and James. One from Baylor, one from TCU. James actually graduated last year. He's taking the walk. He's taking the walk this weekend. So good for Sean. He'll be gone. I'm going to be here with Cecil Shorts shortly. Cecil and I comprise 67% of every 114th overall selection the Jaguars have had. The other guy, and this is ironic enough, the other guy is Aaron Colvin, who doesn't have the most illustrious or glorious history with the Texans and might not be the fondest of memories for a lot of Texans. But Cecil Shorts, Seth Payne, Aaron Colvin, those are the only three guys ever taken with 114th overall pick by the Jaguars. And somehow we all found our way to an intradivisional rival in the Houston Texans. Cecil and I decided to stick around for a while. Obviously, the big news yesterday was the Astros in what might have been one of the most glorious victories in a one of three series where somehow I felt like the Astros won the series. I'd been that beaten down emotionally by the Yankees taking the first two and everything that's ensued over the last year plus 3 or 4 months or so, that it felt glorious. It felt great. And yes, it's a regular season win, but I think the biggest difference, obviously, was that Jose Altuve broke out of a 3-for-32 slump and went yard on their pitcher, Green. And it was a really, really great thing to see because as much as I've been the first to say, hey, look, it's fun to get booed by the opposing fans. It's not that big a deal. This is what you live for. You love going into somebody else's house and shutting up the crowd. It's been different with Altuve. You know, I hate to read too much into body language, but he's a guy that never looks like particularly arrogant or confident out there. He bites his nails when he's playing second base, but you could see it weighing on him over the course of the last two seasons. And I don't know if yesterday was like the thing that turns everything around. But Cecil, it's gotta do something, does it not?
Yeah, man. I'm hoping it turns things around for him. Like you mentioned, the last season, I kind of gave him the benefit of the doubt. It was COVID, but you know, he went through the yips. He wasn't batting like he normally does on the offensive side. So hopefully this can be a thing where he can really use this to bounce back and get things going. I mean, to be honest, not too many guys can handle Yankee Stadium just booing you and calling you out your name and going crazy.
Yeah, that's
a
difference.
The whole night. That's a big deal. Like that's hard to deal with, especially at that capacity.
I'm glad you brought up the yips, because that actually is one of the most encouraging things I thought right from the first game of the series 3 days ago, 4 days ago, was that he was pretty damn good in the field the whole time. And if it was anything psychological last year at the end of the year when he either had the yips or looked like he had the yips or whatever it was. It looked like he was dialed in and focused. So that part of it, I actually felt, I felt like, okay, wherever he is right now mentally and whatever's, you know, this 3-for-32 stretch he was on started post-COVID, but before Yankees. So that's not all it was. But there is something about the fact that he's taking that entire scandal on his shoulders. And that's a whole lot to weight, a lot of weight to carry for a guy that not wasn't just really well-regarded beforehand, but was beloved and almost universally respected by opposing fan bases. You know, like I would talk to people, I would talk to Yankees fans, or I would talk to Rangers fans or anybody else, and before all the cheating scandal, they would almost universally say, well, you know, yeah, I mean, gosh, that little bastard Altuve, but man, God bless him. Like, look at what a stud he is and look at what he's done at a height of 5'5". That's got it. That's a, you know, like Cecil, if you're kind of a nondescript guy or something,
right,
and all of a sudden you're hated, that's actually, in some respects, it's a step up because you're, you know, you're more elevated. You've got more notoriety. You feel like you're affecting people versus going like from one extreme to the other.
That's very true. I just wonder, why does he think he has to take everything on? I mean, would he be the face of the Astros? I mean, he is who he is. He's awesome. But why do he feel like he has to take everything on? Because you can see it in his body language. You can see it in his post-game interviews. I mean, even yesterday, he seemed just worn out after, you know, he hit his home run, they came through and got the W, but he just seemed worn out, like, oh, like, you know, when is this going to be over?
That's interesting because, okay, there's a few things going on. For one, it's Altuve that killed the Yankees with his walk-off home run in the 2019 ALCS. Before we even talk about cheating scandal or anything, there's that Altuve won the MVP in 2017. And Yankees fans were okay with all of that, you know, for the most part. But then the cheating scandal breaks, and then all of a sudden, everything flips. And anything at all that happened bad to the Yankees versus the Astros now in Yankees fans' minds gets chalked up to cheating. And then the big thing, and this is where I still, like, I've got a grudge against ESPN for this. ESPN nonstop and most national media outlets, whenever they reference the scandal, all of which centered around 2017, they show that picture of Jose Altuve, you know, trying to keep his jersey on, which by the way, Cecil, he's been doing since as early as 2015. Like, I went back to watch different walk-offs of Jose Altuve, and it's been kind of like a constant little cat and mouse they play, like, after when Jose comes home, where they try to rip his jersey off. And then he had, you know, we find out later he had a half-finished tattoo and all that. But there are a lot of Yankees fans who are convinced that Jose Altuve was cheating in 2017, even though there's a lot of evidence that shows he's one of three guys that chose not to participate. And then they also, there are a lot of them that just still assume, almost as a matter of fact, that Altuve was wearing a buzzer. And that somehow everybody in the league knew it except for Altuve's own teammates, who had to be reminded not to tear his jersey off. So that's, in a nutshell, that's why Yankees fans think that Altuve was the worst of the guys who cheated in 2017, and then they roll 2019 and everything else up into it. And Altuve, to his credit, and I don't know if this is by direction or of the league, or by direction of the Astros, but Altuve's never said a single thing in his personal defense. He's all been about supporting the team. So I guess that's where, to answer your question, yeah, why is Altuve taking all of it? Part of it is through no choice of his own, but then I do think part of it is either because he's trying to do the noble thing and do it for his teammates, even though it looks like there's a really good chance that he was, like, the least culpable of all of them. Mm-hmm. But also, I wonder if the team or the league had as part of the agreement that you guys just got to shut up about this after the opening day statements or the opening of spring training statements.
Well, I think that's noble that he's doing that, but at the same time, if this is messing up your game, if this is messing up your mental, if this is too much for you to handle, say something. Hey, I didn't have nothing the heck to do with this. Like, get this off of me.
Yeah.
You see something, like, listen, get me out of this. I was one of the few guys that didn't do anything. I'm just naturally good. I'm just able to pick it up.
That's what I want in a book someday. And I know Gaddis has spoken kind of openly about it on a podcast. Right. I got to go back and listen to the entire podcast. Nobody's really dished on it that was involved in it. And I'd love someday for, you know, maybe Josh Reddick, Tony Kemp, and Jose Altuve are the guys who, you know, from various statements and from the Astros fan that did the study of the sound of the thumps during that season, those look like the three guys who didn't do anything at all. And, yeah, you wonder if at some point, you know, like maybe Reddick or Kemp says, all right, enough is enough. I'm sick of being wrapped up in all of this. This is what happens. But I think the same thing that kept those guys from participating in the cheating also kind of makes them the kind of guys that maybe feel a sense of duty to their teammates. They're guys that are trying to do the right thing all the time, which is a miserable place to be sometimes. Sometimes it's the hardest thing in the world to be in that spot. But we've got Cecil Shorts in today. As I said, Cecil and myself are two-thirds of the only 114th selection overall by the Jacksonville Jaguars. We've got to be breaking some kind of radio record.
Who's
today.
Who's the third?
Eric Colvin.
Really?
Yeah. All of us ended up playing for the Jaguars and then the Texans, like in that order, right?
That is pretty
cool. You went
to Tampa
after.
Yeah, that is pretty cool.
So this is what's notable about you, Cecil. You've also, and this is relevant to this year, you've played with 2.5 rookie quarterbacks. I'm going to count Jameis Winston as half a rookie when you played with him in his second year. So I want you to tell me exactly what it's like playing with potentially a Davis Mills or some other rookie quarterback next. Sean Pendergast is out this morning. I'm joined by former Jacksonville Jaguar, Cecil Shorts. Sean's watching both his sons graduate. Sammy is actually graduating. James graduated last year, and he's a working man now, but he's going to go walk during the ceremony. So good for Sean, who now has three college graduates that have sprung forth from his loins. It's a damn impressive accomplishment. Cecil Shorts, I feel like you've sprung forth 2.5 quarterbacks from your loins. Because you, I mean, the actual literal children, you have a ton. So there's that. But then also, look, you've played for two rookie quarterbacks, Blaine Gabbert in 2011, who was drafted the same year as you, Blake Bortles, and then when you went to Tampa, Jameis Winston was in his second year. Yep. So I'm guessing Jameis Winston still had some rookie tendencies in him. What would you say about playing with a rookie quarterback? And I'm thinking about specifically Davis Mills. And what should we expect if we end up getting Davis Mills in halfway through the year? And he's like, I'll go out on a limb and say Davis Mills is not going to be as electric as Deshaun Watson was, and that he might end up looking a little bit more like a Blaine Gabbert than a Deshaun Watson.
Yeah, rookie quarterbacks is always interesting. All the eyes are on them, especially when you're the only. Or you're the early round pick, right? With Blaine, with Blaine and Blake, they were the first round draft pick.
So yeah,
eyes were always on them. Every single thing they did. Even this year with Davis, he's the first pick of this year's draft, and he's a quarterback in a situation with Deshaun Watson. We don't know what's going to happen. So his eyes will always be on him—the good, the bad, the ugly. So all the players are going to be watching his every move. Just naturally, can he do this? What does he look like under pressure? Can he lead the offense? How's his leadership skills? How does he carry himself? That's the biggest thing early on. What's his mannerisms like? Can he throw? Is he talented? And then as time gets closer, camp goes on. Okay, let's see him against the ones. How's he do against the ones? Oh, he's not doing bad. He can sling that thing. Or let's see some impressive throws. Can he be on the right hash and throw it out on the left side? Or can he whip it down the field 60 yards? So we're watching every single thing that he does. And then it's preseason. All right, preseason, can he play, right? Mm-hmm. Can he get out there and can he play? That's his first NFL action. Can he get out there and go out there and just ball? Because, Seth, it's guys that go out there for a practice and they're all Americans and they get in the game and they fold, right?
Yeah.
So there's so much that goes on with that.
Yeah, everything looks great in August, and you're going along, and he makes some impressive throws. I'm glad you said that about making the impressive throws, because I even used to be like that with David Carr his rookie year, and it didn't work out with David, obviously. But in practice, he'd make some pretty damn impressive throws, and you look at it, and like you're just like a fan at that point.
You are.
You get excited. For a receiver, I guess, I always wonder with receivers that it must be kind of like a basketball player with a point guard, right, where like all you know about a quarterback – or all you know about a point guard, and a lot of times when you're a basketball player, is, all right, this guy gets me the rock. Like, this guy, okay, when things are going well. So as a receiver, you're evaluating a quarterback especially, right, where in practice, when you're open, or when you're supposed to be the read there and you're getting the ball, then all of a sudden you start to get that confidence. And I guess could you see in Blaine Gabbert or Blake Bortles that maybe – there wasn't anything special there early on, or were you kind of open to the experience?
I was open to the experience. See, I'm too optimistic, Seth. I'm too optimistic. I'm like, oh, we got a guy coming in. He came, especially Blaine. He came in with me. And Blaine was highly regarded coming out. And he was the youngest quarterback in his class coming out. He had the arm strength. He had the long hair looking like Trevor Lawrence or Sunshine at the time.
So yeah, he looked the part.
He did look a part. I mean, he can run. He was athletic. But we put him in a bad situation because early in training camp, I mean, we saw everything we wanted to see. It was just a matter of when we came in, they said David Garrard is the guy. And then next thing you know, 2 weeks later, they cut David Garrard before the first game of the season. So now you got Luke McCown, plays two games, and then you throw Blaine in there, and Blaine starts seeing ghosts. Like, he just wasn't ready. So, like,
which
you look for
– that was kind of the knock on him coming out of school, though, too, was that he was a little bit skittish in the pocket.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, so, he wasn't standing in the pocket at all. And as a receiver, that's frustrating because I need you in the pocket for me to get open. Like, it's timing routes, right? So if I'm running the glance, a five-step glance, for you, it's two steps or three steps, boom, 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 and the ball is out. But if you catch it and start scrambling, what the heck are you doing? Like, I'm supposed to get the ball here.
That's where, and I wonder with Davis Mills, because one of the knocks on him has been that in his limited experience, he's been pretty much all or nothing. Like, he's got to get rid of the ball fast, or he kind of falls apart, or he's not patient enough to see things through. And I don't know if that's something you necessarily see really until the regular season, like you said, because in the preseason, you're facing vanilla coverages. Yep. You're not facing the best pass rushers necessarily. I know that it's hard because the quarterbacks or the receivers also aren't always running the right routes because you're working with backups. But I guess with Jameis Winston, what did you see in Jameis Winston's second year compared to maybe how he did or did not develop?
He was still very, how do I want to put this? He was still very immature. And
really?
How he was a leader. He's a natural leader. Like, people naturally gravitate to him. But some of the things he would do was like, yo, you're still acting like you're in high school. I remember Thursday night, we had a game versus the Atlanta Falcons, and we got murdered or whatever. But early in the game, we were still in the game, and I run an in-cutting route. About 12 yards, and I cut in, and I'm coming, and he scrambles out the pocket, and he throws a ball, and it skips to me. And I'm coming, and I'm a vet. I think it's my sixth or seventh year by then. And I'm coming downhill to meet him, and the ball still skips. I even dive for it. He's like, he runs to me as soon as the ball skips during the play. Like, the play just ended. Runs to me.
Yeah.
Hey, and puts his hands up, like, yelling at me. And he's not really he's not really yelling, but he's like, hey, I need you to come back downhill more. I'm like, how much more do you want me to come downhill? You skipped the ball to me. But, like, little stuff like that. So, on TV, it looks like.
Oh, on TV, it looks like, Cecil ran the wrong route.
Yes, on TV, it looks like I ran the wrong route. And people will text me, like, hey, what was Jameis talking about? Do we need to jump him? Like, no, he's good. But little things like that, it's just in this immaturity. And then he was still developing. He was the one-read guy. He would just throw it up, hoping you make a play. So, it was just some little things that he just wasn't and I think he's a good quarterback now, or a decent quarterback now, but you can still see the young things where if his first read wasn't there, he just started to scramble instead of going second, third, and check down.
Yeah, and some of that is stuff that, you know, some guys never learn it. Some guys, it just takes a while and takes experience. And that's one of the big transitions of playing with grown men who know the game better than you versus you playing with other college boys that don't necessarily know the game as well as you. Cecil Shorts is in for Sean Pendergast today. Something happened in the Yankees game yesterday, and I got to tell you, it's the worst feeling in sports, the feeling that Ryan Pressly had when he realized he had messed up in the middle of a very important play. Cecil and I have both had that experience. We'll tell you about it next. Hey, Sean Pendergast is out today. He's going to watch both his sons graduate this weekend, Sammy from Baylor and James from TCU. So he's now got three adult children, basically. Good for Sean. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Wait, his daughter hasn't officially graduated. She's just taken a year off. So she has yet to graduate. He's two-thirds of the way there. The Astros win yesterday, and it felt like a series victory because of all of the emotion that's wrapped up into this series, the fact that the Astros had lost two in a row, the fact that Altuve had just been the focus of so much anger and vitriol from Yankees fans. It was nice to see Altuve get a home run. It was nice to see Yordan homer twice off of Gerrit Cole. Maldonado. What's everybody know, Cecil? At some point, Maldonado is going to kill your vaunted bullpen. Everybody in baseball knows that. You can't pitch to Maldonado. Maldonado. Cecil, when Maldonado hit a two-run homer, he had been 0 for his – he hadn't had an RBI in his last 75 at-bats.
Oh, wow.
It was – yeah, yeah. It was – it's been kind of a dry spell for Maldonado. But there was some hairiness in the eighth inning when Ryan Pressly was at the mound, Gleyber Torres was at first base, and Aaron Hicks was at the plate. The score at that point was 5-3 Houston. And there was a heavy shift on versus Hicks. So Alex Bregman was, you know, not at third base anymore. Aaron Hicks hits a base hit up the middle. Carlos Correa flubs it a little bit. Gleyber Torres is on his way to second. And there's nobody at third base because of the shift. So Gleyber Torres trucks on over towards third base. This is all very confusing as the play was unfolding. When you're watching on television, you're like, I had my head down. My wife, Brandy, was watching, and she jumped up. So I'm trying to figure out what the hell's going on in the middle of all this. And Gleyber Torres gets to third. The third base coach tells him to stay. But meanwhile, Maldonado is rushing out to cover third, and there's nobody at home place. So Torres trucks on into home. And Correa, who fumbled with the ball, and then, you know, in a very Correa-like fashion, took his time getting over to the ball. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But I can't fault Correa because what's Correa do? He can't throw to Maldonado, who's on the third base path at that point, because there's no way in hell Maldonado's going to catch the ball and then catch Torres, you know, who's already on his way home at that point. So it's – and Dusty Baker afterwards wouldn't even completely call out Ryan Pressly and say that the pitcher should have covered home. He said that it might have been Yuli's responsibility to cover home, but that frankly he gets a little bit confused sometimes with all the shifting and the shifting rules. It was like Ryan Pressly, if you're standing there and you could see it in Ryan Presley's face on one of the replays they showed. At that point, I went back to both broadcasts. I went back and watched the Yankees breakdown of it. So I don't know if the Astros broadcast showed Presley's face, but there was a point in the middle of everything where Pressly realized, oh crap, nobody's at home and I should be at home. That is the worst damn feeling, especially when it could potentially cost you a game on in a situation where you should have been made a whole lot more comfortable right there. Have you ever had a moment quite like that in a game?
Oh my gosh. Too many my rookie year. I remember going up playing I think the third game of my rookie year, and I get out there first time, we line up, and I'm like, all right, I know what I got to do. I get on the ball. And when you're on the ball, as you know, you can't move when you're on the ball. So I'm on the ball, and then he looks at my way and raises his hand, like sending me in motion. And I'm like, wait a second. I can't be in motion, but there's nobody over there but me. So yeah. I jog that way to get in motion, not getting off the ball, just jog that way. And they send the whistle, goes, I'm like, I was just nervous. I'm like, I messed up totally. Like, I have no idea. I was just rookie year, not knowing what's going on, just going in motion because he waved at me. But he actually gave me a signal. So I had no clue what was going on. Later in that game, I'm, you know, because as a rookie, you get like a package. They give you about the package between 5 to 10 plays, basically what you can handle. I was early in my career, and I wasn't knowing too much at the time. So I get out there. It's a play designed for me. I was more of the deep ball guy early on, and I'm supposed to run a post route. I get out there, and I run a full-on go route. And this is a timing throw. So he drops back 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 and lets the ball go towards the middle of the field. I'm all the way outside of the numbers.
Yeah.
And I see the ball and I'm like, and it hits me. It's floating
in slow motion.
So
yeah.
I'm just trying to run to the middle of the field and the guy intercepts it. And then I get my butt chewed on the sideline. What are you doing?
Did you ever go back and watch that on television and see what it actually looked like?
No. Heck no.
Because I wonder, it's so funny. Because there's sometimes, depending on who the color commentator is, the guy will realize, like, okay, somebody ran the wrong route there.
Yeah.
And sometimes it won't be. Usually if it's like a former offensive or defensive lineman in the booth, sometimes what was he thinking? I go, what a stupid throw. I mean, what are you even looking at? That's where receivers get off the hook. Because you don't even know. I mean, you wouldn't even know who necessarily, unless you're in the booth and you recognize the route combination, you're not necessarily going to know who ran the wrong route in that situation. So it's, yeah, with And for defensive players, totally and completely, it's losing contain. Like, you never run faster than when you've blown contain, where you bite on a fake or something, and you realize, like, oh no. I remember doing it versus John Elway, and I bit on the run, and John Elway was off on a boot. And he was so, like, I say deceptively fast, not because he was a white guy, but because he was, like, old and hobbling. But he was still so fast. Like, and he ran the boots so well that, like, by the time you realize you screwed up, you look out and he's just off by himself out in the, like George Clooney in that space movie where he's tumbling through space all alone. Well, that's how alone he is.
Let me ask you this, because once they beat contain, it's so hard to catch them. But I feel like every D lineman or linebacker put their head down and just hustle as hard as they can. But why? You run
a 4.640 because you're just it's fear. It's fear and terror of your defensive line coach, your head coach.
If
you're playing for Coughlin, especially, you're like, oh my gosh, they're like somehow, some way, I got to make up for this. Plus, sometimes what'll happen is, for one, if somebody slows them down, then you can get a lick on him, you can't get in on the play. And then, or if he turns back in, that's a nice opportunity for a stripped ball or something. The worst one I did versus the Texans, like a mental error when I was with the Texans, was when we were playing the Cardinals and David Boston was a receiver. And for the kids who don't know or remember, David Boston was this just massively chiseled wide receiver.
Huge.
He looked like a defensive end. He might as well have been Julius Peppers. So I'm down in my stance. And, you know, we had a play called where the front and the actual blitz was going to change if the strength of the offense changed. So I'm down in my stance, and I see a tight end come in motion across the formation. So I changed the call myself from a Lucky to a Ringo. I reset the other defensive lineman. It turns out that tight end was actually David Boston. And so I completely screwed the whole, we got screwed on that play. That was a bad one. The other bad one was when we were playing the Colts and Peyton Manning. I'd figured out what Peyton Manning's audibles were in that game. But it was really, really loud. We were down in the end zone, in the red zone, and Peyton Manning was audibilizing, and it was so loud that he was going out to, walking out to the tight ends and the tackles and shouting at them. And I was trying to hear what he was saying. So one time, it worked a couple times. I knew what play they were running. So the third time I tried it, I walked out with Peyton Manning, like listening to what he was saying, and Peyton had the center direct snap the ball to the running back, like as I was out of position. They ran right up my hole. And that one was one where like the fight or flight instinct kicks in, and I had that adrenaline surge because I knew I'd messed up so bad that I actually made a tackle on it. That was like when a mother can lift a truck off of her toddler because she gets that superhuman burst of energy.
Yeah.
That was so I don't know. When I was watching that game yesterday, so when the shift against Aaron Hicks ended up basically giving Torres a chance to come all the way home from first. On television, it was really confusing because you never know what's going on with the shift. That annoys me. I wish they would do a little graphic with where the shift is beforehand. But the other two things were that Hicks has actually started bunting quite a bit against the shift. I just, by happenstance, read an article about it before this series. So I was curious about whether they would actually even shift versus Hicks or not, or if Hicks would try to bunt. And this was far better in this situation. But the other was that I've been against outlawing the shift just because I feel like it's a natural evolution of baseball. And I'm looking forward to the day when maybe guys start becoming better directional hitters to try to combat the shift. But I don't know. Yesterday, I kind of half jokingly said, all right, I'm okay with banning the shift. But I thought about it more afterwards, and I am actually okay with banning the shift and making guys play in their traditional situations.
Why? Those are adjustments during the game. When a guy comes up, you're making a shift based on where he normally hits because of what the film tells you, whatever the analytics say. So you're shifting because he normally hits this way or whatever the case may be. It's an adjustment, right?
I understand the adjustment. The problem is it's too effective. There's too many times during a baseball game where you get excited. You get excited versus hard contact. And you're like, oh, okay. One of your guys has hard contact. You get excited, and it goes directly to the shortstop who set up damn near first base. You know, like okay, I got, or when the second baseman is off in short right field or something, it's a little bit disappointing. And then also, it's one of the things that I think people have a knee-jerk reaction to saying, no, you don't have to mess with baseball. Baseball's just fine. It's different than what it used to be. If you wonder whether baseball's lost some of its appeal, there's not nearly as much action. I'm not even talking about like how many runs scored or anything like that, but actual action when the ball is in play and there's not an immediate out. And part of it's because the shift. Like the Astros a few years ago led the league in defensive shifts, and I can't remember. I want to say it was like 30% of the time or so they shifted. And if they shifted that same amount now, they'd be like 13th in the league. Because some teams, the teams that are shifting the most are shifting like 50% of the time. So like all you would be doing is taking it back to where it used to be, to where it was for like the longest time. And it's not anything that other sports don't do. Every other sport has rules on where guys are allowed to line up. You know, there's the paint rules in basketball. Mm-hmm. Football's got all kinds of rules. Hockey, there's icing and offsides and everything. That's why I'm okay with that part of it. You're just dead set against it, though.
But shifting, I feel like as a batter, right? When you see, because they shift before the pitch. They shift before while you're at bat. You're taught at a young age to be able to pull left or to hit right or just be able to move the ball in different places. Harder to do in the MLB. But wouldn't you think they'll be able to make adjustments at the batter's box?
No, I think it's just harder.
It's just harder?
It's one of those things. I've talked to enough big leaguers about it that like it's just not so simple. There's some guys that have always been good at it and can do it, but now there is the bunt. I mean, Jordan bunted to get and then the Yankees. The Yankees didn't have a shift on a couple times versus Jordan where you might expect them to have shifted, and maybe that's part of it. They know he's got that capability. Yeah, I do wonder over time whether they're just going to get better at it. The other thing that kind of hit me in the gut yesterday in terms of just making me remember what it's like to actually be a player was this: there's some good old fashioned animosity between the players' union in the NFL, because the NFLPA put out a statement that called the NFL basically gutless. Because the NFL is in a situation now where the NFLPA has recommended that players not attend their team's workouts, their off-season workouts, unless they're mandatory, for safety considerations. Also, because they say that the workouts have just gotten too aggressive. They're not as they're not good for the preservation of players' health. All of that. So when Juwan James tore his Achilles tendon just the other day, the NFL sent out a memo to all the teams, reminding people, saying, "Hey, if you get injured away from the facility, the player might have to pay back some of his guaranteed money, or he might not be due the money that's owed him, all of that stuff, might void some of the guarantees." So the NFLPA fires back and says, "It was gutless to use a player's serious injury as a scare tactic to get you come running back to these workouts." And it's been advising rookie players and everybody else not to report to these off-season workouts. I'm torn on this one because, man, I could not for the life of me tell a young guy like a seventh-round draft pick,
you can't,
or an undrafted rookie free agent, hey, be part of our battle against the league and like whatever saber rattling we're doing here, just go ahead and piss off your head coach and go ahead and stay home. Do you feel like the NFLPA, as a former NFLPA member yourself, do you feel like the NFLPA is going a little too far in advising rookies and other players that really need to impress the coaches to stay home?
Way, way, way too far. Honestly, if I was the NFLPA, I would tell the rookies to go about your business. Simply go to it. This has nothing to do with you. You guys are new. This is about more of the veterans, and you'll get here one day, right? But to tell the rookies they shouldn't do that, you got undrafted guys. You got lower-round guys, 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th. They're trying to make the team. They're trying to impress the coaches. It's not far-fetched you'll see a third-round guy get cut. It's not far-fetched that you'll see guys like not make the team because they fall out of favor with the head coach or the OC or whatever the case may be. So those guys need to be there. A lot of those guys need to understand, start learning the playbook, start learning how to be a pro, start getting around each other and get comfortable getting a routine. So to say, hey, Don't come that stuff. You don't need it. It's A, B, and C. No, you're making it hard for the rookies. And the agents, I'm pretty sure the agents hate it because those guys need – I mean, the agents are taught to put the player in the best situation and give them the best advice for them to have success. So yeah. if they're telling one thing and the team and the veterans on the team are saying another thing, or NFLPA saying another thing, it's like putting a player in a loop. Like, what do I do?
That's where and I think the NFLPA is just stepping out of bounds here. Where J.C. Treader is the new NFLPA president, and it feels like he's trying to maybe mark his territory. Mm. He's lifting his leg up a little bit because I mean that. This is where I'm turning into an old man, Cecil. Like, I used to be all about just like, yeah, screw the owners, go ahead and just, you know, do whatever you got to do and fight the power, all that. You just signed a new CBA last year. Yeah. It's been 1 year. This is something that if you cared about, but what the NFLPA is saying is, well, because of COVID. Man, that feels disingenuous to me. Yeah, you just played a whole season with COVID as a concern. The NFL has shown that they're pretty damn good at managing this stuff. Yep. You know, you had like a 0.001% positive rate. It's time to move on, especially with an organization that was probably more proactive about COVID than anybody else. If I'm a young player right now and I got somebody telling me like, oh no, don't do it. Just go ahead and show David Culley and Nick Caserio that you're one with this union you're not even actually a member of yet. Do you even remember joining the union?
No. I don't. I remember being forced to or just automatically joined or whatever. I don't know if I signed a card or whatever it is, but I don't even remember doing it. I just was taught I was part of it.
I vaguely remember something my rookie year when one of the old crusty vets was like, just sign the paper. I'm like, okay, sir.
That's all it is. Like, I think I remember a card or something. Hey, I want to be a part of it, whatever the case may be. And then, you know, all the guys come, you know, all the, you know, Demora Smith and everybody else comes in and they talk to you and this is important. We got to stick together. Boom, boom, boom. And I didn't know no better. I just said, okay.
I know. Especially this year. Where, like, everybody, for the Texans especially, I mean, everybody just, the whole roster is just turned over. You got all these
guys. It's all new players.
Yeah.
Everybody's new.
Yeah, everybody's new. And, like, you know what it is. They're trying to create this competitive environment. And there's that whole mandatory voluntary thing.
Yes.
You know, like, there's that whole, like, yeah, look, this is completely voluntary, but we're taking names of who's there and who's not. Yeah. And I just wouldn't.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, I was just thinking, like, if I'm a vet, I probably, the way I was, I still worked out at the facility.
Yeah.
Like, I wanted my time away. So I'll probably come back after the Super Bowl, slowly start getting back into it. And there's times where I would go other places and train. But for the most part, I was at the facility. I trusted those guys. I knew what was going on. They took care of me. I had everything I needed. I didn't have to pay. I had everything I needed there in the training room and everything and eating. So I was at the facility, I don't know, 80% of the time during the off season.
Yeah, I didn't like going to – well, for one, I didn't like going to normal gyms anyway because it's sometimes you just want to be able to focus on your workout and do your workout. If you're away from Houston, then you're probably not going to get bothered too much. But, like, when you're in Houston, people are going to come up to you and talk to you at the gym, which is fine and cool, except that you also, like, just want to get an intense workout in.
Yep.
So there's that. And then there's the whole part of just if you do get injured, then you'd like to be right there. I'd like to be right there where they can help me. And it's cheap. Like I can go work out at the facility.
Everything is there that you need.
Yeah. Like do you know how much they charge at a lot of those other workout places? It's crazy.
Yeah.
I remember going off to I can't remember how much I paid for my combine training because I worked out with Tom Shaw. It was probably worth it, but I can remember at the time I had like borrow money from my mom for it. I didn't have an agent that was paying for any of that or anything.
Ah.
So my mom paid for it, you know, and I told her, I told her I'd pay her back. And like, I don't know if she probably wasn't expecting me. I don't know if my mom expected me to actually get drafted. It seemed kind of like a fantasy to her. So she's like, all right, Seth, this is the one last time I'll pay for something for yourself. So it was a nice surprise for her when I actually paid her back.
There you go. There you go.
So, look, Adam Schefter made a whole lot of news on draft day, and a lot of people are accusing him of being way out of line with the way he handled the Aaron Rodgers news, and it has implications for the Deshaun Watson news and the whole Texans scenario. We'll talk about that next.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.